Right now it is time for David Tarachuk. It is time for the Media Beat. David, of course, joins us live on a Friday morning. We rebroadcast David on the weekend and also on Monday following our 12 noon news. David has his own website, which is themediabeat.us. He is a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. And he this morning is in the great state of Maine. Good morning, David.
Yeah, good morning. It's good to be with you again, Marshall. I'm no longer in New York, the media capital of the world, and also for a long time the epicenter of the COVID disease. Now it's no longer the epicenter, of course, but fourth from the top in the highest states in time in terms of COVID cases, places like California, Florida, and Texas. And I'm now in Maine, yes, which is a very different state and sixth from the bottom of the baleful league table, with only Alaska, Montana, Wyoming, Hawaii, and Vermont below us. It's a terrible number anyway, but it's a smaller number than many states, 4,000, fewer than 4,000 cases and deaths in all the months that have had COVID dominating our news and our understanding of the world as a whole. The grand total the total in Maine only is 122, with one death reported yesterday, and that's not a very frequent occasion. The number of deaths being reported has really dwindled in the state of Maine, and so you know it's a very different setting I find myself in.
You know, we've been in that different kind of setting here in Northwest Connecticut, even though we have had one death in Canaan and multiple COVID-19 cases throughout the northwest corner of Connecticut. But Connecticut per capita has been one of those states that in the beginning was right there at the top. You look at the latest news when we talk about COVID-19 and how the pandemic has gone home to roost in the administration of Donald Trump, with another administrative member getting sick with COVID-19, and a former Republican presidential candidate passing away due to COVID-19.
Indeed. When it comes to the numbers, we're finding that the changes made by the Trump administration in collecting information is now proving to be as ineffective as so much else in this administration's handling of the crisis. Taking the reporting of cases away, for the collecting of reports on cases away from the CDC was a bright idea of this administration, thinking that they could do it better by having it reported directly to the administration itself, to the Department of Health and Human Services. And it's turning out that it's not working out at all well. The numbers are behind time. They're not being kept up to date. So when it comes to policy making and tactical shifts and the like, which states and local bodies will, public bodies will need that information for, all the decision making that would take place is now having to wait on a very cumbersome and very evidently ineffective information handling. The way to handle a public health crisis like this, of course, is to keep the public informed, and of course to keep the responsible public authorities, decision makers, well informed too. And if that's not happening, you've gotten to the core of the kind of problem that this administration has really brought upon itself by being, by turns, overconfident, blasé, at first brushing it off as an unimportant issue, not likely to threaten us, through all sorts of twists and turns since, denial and blame and finger-pointing. And more and more, what's being shown is the total inefficiency at the heart of it.
Yeah, what's interesting is we're going to report the numbers daily, but now they're going to report the numbers weekly. And hospitals and health agencies across the country are saying weekly does not do them any help. What they use those numbers for is to try to plan in advance to see where hotspots are and where they might be affected. And weekly releases of those figures just are not going to cut it for these places.
Right. There's no way to get a sense of the flow of the crisis. If you're a week out of date, you're already way out of date when it comes to planning what to do next. Maine is a very instructive example, and if you have your sound effects deck ready, Marshall, I want to call into play our Find the Good and Praise It fanfare for this week, because Maine itself is, and in particular the Maine public broadcasters are exhibiting an extraordinary example of how well to handle a public health crisis. Is the fanfare ready?
And the fanfare is ready. There you go.
I want to blow the bugle for Maine Public. Maine Public Broadcasting now gives itself a different name. I'm not sure I want to fanfare this particularly, but rather like NPR, it doesn't want to be known as radio anymore. It just calls itself NPR, just the letters. They don't want you to think of the R standing for radio. Maine Public is now what the entity is called in this state. It doesn't want to be known as either radio or television because, of course, you know, it's a media outfit, and of course, you know, has other things going for it besides old-style terrestrial broadcasting of either audio on radio or video and audio on television. So Maine Public is doing a fantastic public service. I don't want to be waspish about the name, but I do want very much to praise their coverage, their COVID coverage. There's a briefing that's carried daily by all the services that Maine represents on radio and television and web, and of course on social media too. And it's such a fine example of what public broadcasting can do. And this goes on in your state too, but I think there's a crispness and a sharpness to what's being done in Maine. It's so simple. The politicians are not in charge of this. Occasionally, the governor, Janet Mills, the first female governor of Maine, in office since only last year. Will come when there's some very broad and high agenda setting kind of policy statement to make, but generally speaking, it's in the hands of the medical professionals. There's a very competent director of the CDC for the state, the Maine's own CDC, Dr. Nirav Shah, who basically co-hosts this with the Commissioner for Health and Human Services, Jean Lambrew, but together and actually mainly Dr. Shah will field questions from the media and make a very crisp opening statement each day of the statewide state of the disease and the state's coping with the disease. There's something so brisk and clear and straightforward, and there's no spinning going on. There's a very straightforward factual dealing with factual essences of this crisis. And it's extraordinarily reassuring and fact-facing. It's grim at times. I mean, it has been grim at times when they had to report you know, negative developments in their coping with the disease, but they're also very straightforward in handling it, and without any of the political hoo-ha that we see in so much of the rest of the country. And I just wanted to make it known that Maine is being exemplary in this case.
You know, when we look at COVID-19 across the globe, the latest story that has an interesting twist is once again in Hong Kong, where elections have been pushed off, and a lot of people are saying, well, no, it's not because of COVID-19. It's because of the way the public's reaction to the one country, one city.
Two systems.
Yeah, well, it's not really two anymore.
Yeah, well, exactly. The erosion of the two systems into one. Uh-huh.
So they have.
Well, that idea of delaying an election and blaming it on COVID is, of course, familiar to us now, and it was only a matter of time before the chief of the Trump administration, Mr. Trump himself, the president for now, puts it about that. That he thinks it would be a good idea to delay the election. Now, United States elections are not to be delayed easily. It's baked into the Constitution that making that kind of change is just not on. But nonetheless, our president wants to root that about and try. I guess he's serious in wanting to raise it in order to achieve it. And you can see, of course, many reasons besides concern over COVID and the effect of so many postal ballots, as people don't want to stay, people who want to stay away physically from the polling stations because of COVID. It could be seen just as importantly for him as an opportunity to put off a fateful day when he might actually lose the election.
And what's interesting about that is just yesterday a picture was released of Donald Trump signing what? A provisional ballot back in 2012. He signed a provisional ballot to vote by mail.
Indeed. I mean, he, like many people, it's for him, it's a convenient way to vote, as it is for many of us. Now, if millions of people, and you know, possibly tens of millions, it's being anticipated now, opt for mailing in voting, then of course it's going to be a strain on the system, and we may have to, at the very least, wait longer than we're used to for the results being announced. But these are trying times and challenging, and we have to live with the challenges. I don't think the concern about mail-in voting is anything more than a cover for anxiety about entering an election which is likely to lose.
Well, and it was interesting yesterday to see almost every major Republican come out and say, well, first of all, if anything was going to happen, it would happen in the Congress of the United States. But second of all, elections are held in this country in the time of war, famine, strife. It doesn't matter. No presidential election has ever been delayed.
Right. Article 2 of the Constitution is very clear about that. But this is Donald J. Trump, and the constitutional matters are not at the top of mind for this particular individual, it seems.
We would be remiss if we did not talk about the funeral for John Lewis, which was held yesterday with three former presidents in attendance.
Indeed, and a fourth sending a written appreciation to be read at the service. And one president, the sitting president, very conspicuous by his absence. Indeed, his only contribution to the commemoration of John Lewis, a founding father, as the last president, Obama, President Barack Obama, called him yesterday, called him a founding father of a better America. But the current president, the best he could do was to tweet about him, a very short tweet saying that he and his wife Melania were sending prayers to and this is interesting grammar, to he and his family, the shortness of the tweet is worth reflecting on, because Trump tweeted out one of his constantly extending tweets, so it ended up about multiple tweets devoted consecutively devoted to Regis Philbin a sad loss too, but nothing at all on the scale of the loss to the nation of John Lewis.
Well, when you look at the history of John Lewis and what he went through to become who he became, it's not that he was alone in that matter. There are a lot of Black Americans that went through John Lewis went through. And became stellar members of the community. But for someone to go through what he went through and then to give his life in service to the country and try to change things for the better in the Congress is just a totally different story.
And as so often with a man of huge influence as he was, he has changed our lexicon too. I think there's a phrase that he was very fond of using, which I see now being adopted very extensively. In relation to him, yes, and to the issues that he wanted to promote, but I think it's the fact that that it is now entering the language and has a resonance across many issues, I think. He talked very evocatively about getting into what he called good trouble. For the sake of promoting the justice and the end of racial discrimination of every kind, he would do it by getting into trouble. Sure, and that's an important lesson in there as we consider a nation beset by very intense and well-purposed protests in the streets. There is a point to making trouble. Very often, and it's a good sobriquet to describe it as good trouble.
Want to switch topics just a second here, and that is economies that are contracting across the globe because of the coronavirus. If ever it was pointed out germ warfare can be successful. Whether or not this was the case or not is not the point. But when you have a global pandemic the size of this and you see the contractions that are happening in just about every single economy, it really is an eye-opening thing.
Yes, the slump, the dramatic slump announced yesterday in America's own gross domestic product is very, very striking. And we are very vulnerable to the health of the nation being interfered with, whether it's by so-called natural causes or indeed it would be very if it were to become if this kind of viral attack ended up being weaponized as a military attack, then of course you could see horrendous damage being caused to a nation being attacked. It's just one more signifier for the nation's vulnerability in many ways, and of course, China, as the place of origin, has suffered badly too. It's had the most distinctive lack of expansion for the first halt called to its economic progress, its remarkable economic progress over the last 15 years or so. and it will take considerable time for it to recover. And interestingly, it will doubtless be reshaping its economy, too. It's no longer going to be the same kind of vast market for the rest of us producers as it has been. And if anything, it will be gearing its economy to even greater self-sufficiency than it was directed to before. There will be enormous implications flowing from COVID's impact upon nation states across the entire world.
And this is one thing why I never understood the administration's response to this.
You are not alone.
Because it's such a significant, the pandemic is such a significant worldwide impact that the federal government basically telling all 50 states to go it alone and not have any federal leadership in response to the pandemic really is going to cause serious problems on the back end, especially as we come into flu season and we go into the winter side. I mean, this really could turn our economy upside down for at least the next couple of years.
At least, I would say. What's become very clear is that if ever there was a time when going it alone was not a good idea, it's when you've got a universal epidemic that has become a pandemic, literally a pandemic. Every single country, well, I'm going to exaggerate now, but every single country in the world is affected by this. There are very few and very small nations that manage to escape its effects. And inevitably, the impact will be lasting.
Not only lasting, but now also because there's no federal oversight or management of it, the effects of it are not quantified. I don't know if you know what I mean, but the federal government has a way of when they step into emergency situations, whether they're hurricanes, whether they're tornadoes, when the federal government steps in with FEMA and other organizations, you can quantify the effects, the short term, the long term effects. But when the federal government is so absent, it's really impossible to quantify the long-term effects, never mind on the economy, but on health. I mean, we're just finding out that anybody who comes down with COVID-19 could potentially have serious long-term health effects that we don't even know about yet.
Yeah, absolutely. Examining assessing is one thing. Managing is something else entirely. And the template has been set in this country for a long time now that anything that is as substantial and as impactful as this gets handled at the federal level. We have FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and yet the course taken by this administration and all its public information efforts have been directed in this same way. Is to say that it's virtually a matter of every state for itself, rather in the same way that on the global level we've turned our backs on the international agencies, the World Health Organization in particular, that are the only avenue by which you can, as a planet, can react to something which is in its perniciousness entirely global.
You know, and looking at the way the administration has politicized the pandemic with schools reopening, I go over this a lot with different people. As far as I know, there's not one teacher, not one student that doesn't want to go back to school. There's not one college student. There's not one college teacher. There's not one university. There's not one high school or grammar school that doesn't want to resume and get back to school. But they all want to do it safely, and because there's no federal oversight, of course you have different states that are at different positions in the growth or the shrinking of the pandemic, and it makes the job for educators even that much harder and for parents that much harder, really, to come across and understand what's going on in their own states.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is the nature of the arguments that are used to support that, potentially over hasty opening up again. Much is made of the fact that, as you say, no one's going to argue against education for all and education being available in person, ideally. But you can see the ripples as the informational flow goes and the spinning it takes place from the administration outward. Really, what's going on here is a desire to crank up the economic engine of the country. Have parents able to go back to work again when otherwise they would be having to look after their kids at home. That's the subtext throughout all of this, and it's so revealing of what the priorities of the administration are. And it's not surprising when you see that they're having to deal with a gross domestic product that has slumped as dramatically as yesterday's figures demonstrated. This smacks of institutional, of administrational panic. And it's almost as if they're saying children's health and the nation's health that depends upon children getting infected and perhaps bringing disease home back into their own homes, that can be well tolerated because it's much more important to get the machinery of the economy geared up again. I'm not saying that that's what every single person in authority making this argument wants to happen, but it's an indication of what is the more important thing in their minds. Is it the economy, or is it the health of the nation? And the very fact that you have to consider that as a binary question is so revealing of a leaderless administration. I mean, an administration that has no sense of its own civic duty to its own citizens.
And one final minute or two we have left, you add all that in with the fact that Congress has retired, basically, without fixing the unemployment problem. Now, there's not one person on the face of the earth, I think, that thinks that the $800 a week unemployment settlement was going to continue ad nauseum, because it's just not acceptable. But to now take those people who were on unemployment and bring them back down to the $200 a week level is only going to further put more stress on our economic situation.
Sure, that takes place this very day. The $600 payment passed as federal unemployment benefits is now ending and being replaced by what? Nothing very clear yet, except for the bruited notion of say $200. Now, the impact on a family of that dramatic change is something that clearly is just not being taken seriously enough by legislators who are prepared to pack up, go home, and say that this will be the kind of Band-Aid. This is the only kind of action we're going to take. That will change, of course, when people see how bad it is in its real impact. But for now, there's a kind of blasé-ness and fecklessness, essentially, that's really appalling and shows through in every press statement that any one of these agencies will make.
And anybody that follows the numbers realizes that when somebody gets an income tax rebate or a stimulus check, they tend to put it in their bank. When people get unemployment benefits, they tend to go out and spend it right away in the economy for rent and for food, and that bolsters the economy. So it's going to be something very interesting to watch over the next week or two, David.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, once again, enjoy the time in Maine. Will you be in Maine again next week when we speak to you?
I certainly will.
Well, enjoy the country life out there, and we'll speak to you next week.
Look forward to that. Bye-bye now.
David Terechuk with the Media Beat here on Robinhood Radio. You can find David, of course, on demand, robinhoodradio.com. Click on Demand. Click on the Media Beat with David Terechuk.